The theremin is an instrument that plays those wavy, out-of-this-world sounds on TV shows like Doctor Who. And in movies and lots of rock songs. The Beach Boys used it in Good Vibrations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. People think it was used on Star Trek, but it's actually a female voice. And the theremin sounds a lot like a voice. Here it is on a podcast intro called The Omnibus. Or at least it sounds like a theremin. And I asked Ken Jennings if it was a theremin, but no word back from Ken. So I'm going with a yes, it's a theremin. Ken's co-host on the podcast, John Roderick, is lead singer and guitarist in the rock band The Long Winters. So my guess is some sort of synthesizer was used for the show's theme song. The theremin was the first electronic instrument, and today there are many, obviously. It was the Moog synthesizer, developed by Robert Moog, that was inspired by the theremin. And the theremin was created by a Russian physicist named Leon Theremin, who was a cellist, too. He was working on a machine that could detect approaching objects. The machine used the sound waves, and while working on the project, he realized it could be used as a musical instrument. And voila, the first electronic musical instrument was born. Welcome back to A Cellarondo. My name is Paula Tuttle, and today we're exploring that instrument that sounds like radio waves, but can also sound like a voice, the theremin. The theremin is probably the first electronic musical instrument, and it was certainly the first mass-produced electronic instrument. Leon Theremin was working on something called proximity sensors. Using radio waves, the proximity sensors could tell how far away objects are. If this sounds like secret spy stuff, well, it is. Or it was. The scientist was trying to make a machine that could employ stealth while monitoring things or people. Theremin created a secret listening device that hung in plain view in the U.S. ambassador's office in Moscow. W. Averill Harriman was the recipient of a gift. It was a big red seal, and inside was a device that, when turned on, sent a radio wave. And with this, the Russians were able to eavesdrop on all the U.S. ambassador's conversations. And I saw this seal in the NSA's Cryptological Museum in Maryland. The museum is on the campus of the NSA, which is not in D.C. or Baltimore, for that matter. It's on a military base west of Baltimore. I made the trip to the museum one day. It was kind of upsetting when I approached the wrong gate and got pulled over and interrogated. True story. The gates are next to each other, and I thought my story was innocent enough. But then later, when I told my story to a worker at the NSA, the person who I asked how to get to the museum in the first place, they said to me, "Don't you think that's exactly what a person trying to sneak into the NSA would use as a cover story?" So beware. I've been to the museum twice. The second time, a few years later, with my husband. After my incident of going in the wrong entrance, he was intrigued and he wanted to relive the whole thing. The first visit, while being detained, quote-unquote, he happened to text, and I texted back sort of as a joke, but partly truthful, "I'm being detained by the NSA." And he texted back 3 question marks, and I explained my situation, and well, then a long thread ensued, mostly jokes, because I was sitting in my car for about 30 minutes while this nice lady in a military uniform was in her vehicle investigating me, and her partner Gomer Pyle kept gawking at me, making me wonder what they were discovering about me. And my husband said they were probably watching PBS documentaries where I was on camera playing cello. It was one of those things that seemed funny at the time, and it makes a good story later. And I was allowed to go to the museum in the end. So in the Cryptological Museum, there's a lot of artifacts from the Cold War. Alan Turing's Enigma machine is among them. George Bush's phone, where he got the call on 9/11, is there. It's quite quaint and worth the visit. And not to be missed, the gift shop, which I confess was one of my main reasons to visit the Cryptological Museum. They sell mugs with the NSA emblem that changes when you put hot coffee in it or a drink. And there's a couple of puzzles. And I bought over a dozen pencils that also change color when your hand warms them up. It's a great test to see if you're warmed up after scales. Just don't do what I did. Don't approach the gate with the big red stripes. The museum is in the far left corner of the parking lot for the NSA building, and it's pretty cool. So it's actually a replica of Theremin's device in a big red seal with the American Eagle emblem cast in ceramic that's on display. It looks like something a high school student made in ceramics class. Pretty ugly. The shiny glaze and all. It's the size of a really big dinner plate. The big red seal was called the Great Bug Seal, and it was later dubbed The Thing, and it's in Wikipedia as The Thing. And it was one of the first bugs or covert listening devices to use passive techniques to transmit an audio signal. The device is also the predecessor to the RFID, radio frequency identification technology. It's what we're all being warned about. Your information can be lifted electronically. So to protect our passports and credit cards, you can buy sleeves that guard against theft. But thanks to Leon Theremin, we have this cool instrument. I don't blame him for the other things, because someone was going to discover radio waves and devices to listen or steal your embedded codes anyway. But the fact that a musician, a cellist, was also a scientist, that's not something that can be expected or taken for granted. The theremin was an unexpected byproduct of radio technology. Leon Theremin's lifespan actually embodies the entire existence of the Soviet Union. He worked as a scientist for his government, was a political prisoner for part of his life, and he contributed a great deal to the war effort in his home country. But he's remembered as a creative genius, an inventor by musicians, and considered the father of electronic music. Albert Glimsky wrote an exceptional book about the life of Theremin. Turns out Glimsky's father, like Theremin, grew up in the dusk of Imperial Russia. The two were born a year apart in St. Petersburg. But Glimsky would move to America days before the outbreak of World War I, living his life as a capitalist and peacefully fulfilling his dreams as a sculptor. And Theremin's life went directly opposite. While at the University of Petersburg, he studied physics and astronomy, but soon was discovered by Lenin, who found him very useful. And going forward, he was branded as a Soviet scientist. Theremin's life was not pleasant. He was able to be creative, which he was passionate about, but he would remain under the thumb of the Soviet dynasty. Consider the radio was the most powerful weapon in the First World War. And there you have Leon, or Lev, Theremin, who started dabbling in electricity while he was in grade school. He was conducting experiments with high-frequency currents and magnetic fields at home. Electricity fascinated him. He conducted all kinds of physics experiments, including work with pendulums, and he even created an observatory so he could study astronomy. At age 15, his school principal invited him to stage a whimsical display for the parents and the students. He strung electrical wires over the heads of the audience that would carry a high-frequency electric current. The audience members were each given a sealed vacuum tube with two electrodes. The tubes themselves were the earliest version of a vacuum tube, so this was cutting-edge technology. He basically instructed the audience members to do the wave and hold the tube over their head when each person rose. And when they did, each person's tube lit up when it came within 18 inches of the live wire, as if they became the Statue of Liberty. I like this story because it describes the playful and inventive nature of Lev, which most assuredly led to the invention of the theremin. Because he was as much a musician as a scientist in his formative years, he studied the cello with the principal and solo cello of the Imperial Ballet Orchestra. And the cellist invited him to study at the St. Petersburg Conservatory, which he did. At least for a while. He went on instead to study physics and astronomy at the University of St. Petersburg, and he had more firsthand knowledge of the science than most of the scientists worldwide. In the eyes of the Russian government, electricity was the source of power and the road to the greatest weaponry. Lenin even said, "Electricity will replace God, let the peasants pray to electricity. And Lev Theremin was their pope, their diviner, their medium. When Theremin moved to America in the late 20s, he remained a Soviet informer while ingratiating himself with the glittering New York high life. The theremin was just one of many of his magical musical instruments. And we are fortunate he spent time here because that's where we got to see the man. And those years were indeed the highlight of his professional career as an inventor of musical instruments. At the start of World War II, he was swept back to Soviet Russia in the middle of the night. His Russian biographer, Bulat Galiev, dubs Theremin the Soviet Faust, the name of the book about the scientist, because he basically sold his soul to the devil, meaning the KGB. Theremin was surely a frustrated artist whose musical talents never exempted him from espionage duty. When he was forced to return to the Soviet Union, the stories of an imprisoned Soviet scientist have little hard evidence to support them. For the last 25 years of his life, he was never allowed to write letters. He wasn't even allowed to keep his diplomas or any documentation of his scientific achievements. His biographers encounter hurdles and gaps in even multiple versions of events that make his story even more clouded than the gossip versions of the Cold War. It's a wonder that it was ever invented, and thereminists love the whole spy aspect of the invention. So a theremin is the only musical instrument that is played without actually touching the instrument itself, if you don't consider radio waves a thing, which is fair because we don't consider sound waves a part of a cello or a piano. When you play a theremin, you actually are shaping the waves that come out of the instrument. There are two antennas. One is a curved sort of loop-shaped metal piece that extends off the bottom left side of the instrument, and the other is a long antenna you see like on an old radio. The left hand works with the left antenna in a cupped fashion facing down. It controls the volume. The right hand is cupped facing left, facing the antenna, and it controls the pitch. The closer you get with the right hand, the higher the pitch. You also perform vibrato with the right hand, so it's opposite of the cello or the guitar. The pitches are made by moving the right hand and the vibrato too. You would think a cellist would flip it around the other way. There's a video of Theremin playing the instrument this way, with the right hand doing what a cellist does with the left hand. It does look a little bit like bow technique, the motion he makes, so maybe this is why he flipped the roles of the two hands. The left hand changes the volume, but it moves vertically, so maybe he thought that mimicked the cello too. Robert Moog, his name is spelled M-O-O-G, and many say Moog, because his synthesizers are also called Moog. He seized upon the theremin early on, and he took it to the next level. He now sells the Theremini, a small electronic theremin that doesn't have the nuances the original theremin has. It's more situated to the 24 chromatic tones and probably easier to play in a diatonic fashion. The story of how Theremin discovered the pitches a voltmeter created while conducting experiments of the effects of electricity being absorbed by the human body, also called capacitance, is told in depth in Albert Glinsky's book. Theremin noticed that the movements of his hand near the circuitry were interpreted as fluctuations in density. As he moved his hands closer to the capacitor, the whistle tones became higher. Withdrawing the hand lowered the pitch. Shaking the hand made vibrato. The cellist in Theremin was reawakened. He started fishing for melodies. One of the first was Sanson's The Swan. To get a larger range, Theremin knew to combine two frequencies that collided to form a third and higher frequency. This was the heterodyne principle formulated by Reginald Fessenden in 1901. And Theremin brilliantly applied Fessenden's concept while he was applying the human hands as a capacitance to bring the frequency into human hearing range. And I mention all this because later on, this became an important point when he was defending his patent. So, Lev realized the problem. There was no tactile point, no reference. So far, he had just had rising and falling siren sounds. So he added a foot pedal and a control button for the left hand to cut off the sound of slices from note to note. Eventually, he added new circuitry that allowed the left hand to do this gesture in space as well. It all looked very magical. This new version had a range of 4 octaves, very close to the cello range, and in the lower range did mimic the cello. In the high range, it was more like a violin. Theremin called his instrument the etherphone. He unveiled it to his mentor and professor, Ioffe, on October 1920, and he gave his first public concert a month later. That concert was mostly cello repertoire. A cello solo from a Minkus ballet that's infrequently played now, but remember, his teacher was the principal and solo celloist of the Imperial Ballet. The adagio from the Grand Pas d'Action in Fiametta was the andante cello solo, and it was a staple of soloists that studied repertoire in Imperial Russia. And he also played the Swan in Massenet's Elegy. And here's an interesting aside. The very same month, KDKA here in Pittsburgh launched its radio station, the first commercial broadcasting station. Okay, back to Russia. Lev applied for a patent for his etherphone, and he began performing at symposiums, demonstrations for colleagues, and for public audiences. In 1922, he added piano accompaniment for a demonstration at the Moscow Military Radio Technical Lab, and Lenin attended with a group of comrades. Theremin said he was terrified, and he said for no reason. He said, and quote, "He was a very nice and pleasant person, not very tall, and he treated me like a son." Lenin said to him, "What kind of magic do you have for us?" And Lev explained that there was a keep-away zone, that an alarm would go off if you got too close to the watchman, the producer of the waves. One of Lenin's comrades didn't believe him and approached the instrument with a scarf and set off the alarm. And he said that Lenin delighted in the trap. Then he performed for Lenin, and his repertoire, now well-seasoned, included a Scriabin etude and the Swan. Then Lenin got up and wanted to try it for himself. So Lev stood behind him and moved his hands and let Lenin shadow his movements. They played Glinka's Skylark together. Then Lev removed his hands and let Lenin finish the song practically by himself. And Leon was surprised at how good Lenin's ear was. And of course, everyone applauded Lenin enthusiastically. Afterwards, Leon and Lenin talked at length about physics, astronomy, and electricity. And Leon was impressed that Lenin could grasp the essence of these concepts without being a physicist. But he knew Lenin was a fan of electricity because his future success relied on electricity. Lenin seized on Theremin's etherphone as the perfect propaganda tool. He told Theremin he planned to advertise it in every possible way. He published a book for his propaganda purposes all about electrification of Russia. And he welcomed Theremin as a hero because he proved Russia to be the inventor of a new technology, not just a reshaper. And Leon personified that quest because his penchant for wedding fantasy and reality, he took experiments a step further. How did Theremin's scientific colleagues see him? Well, they were either jealous or just considered him a dreamer. Inventing a musical instrument while the country was desperate for hard solutions from physics? Lenin saw to it that Theremin had a free pass on all railroads so he could demonstrate the etherphone. Lenin wasn't really interested in promoting music. He just wanted to flaunt the Soviet achievement in electricity. So Leon embarked on a roadshow with musicians and actors. He added a few new instruments to the show, an electric fingerboard instrument that was essentially a stringless and bowless cello, and a device he called the Illuminox, which was a wheel that projected lights in accordance with the music. At a concert in 1922, Shostakovich was in the audience. The roadshow included gatherings at factories, colleges, government offices, and recreational centers. He went to outlying cities too, like Minsk and a bunch of towns I can't pronounce. The press reported the success, and the name of the instrument soon fused with the inventor, calling it the Theremin Vox. To Theremin's credit, he donated his concert proceeds to a famine relief fund, and he set up aid for over 25 million people starving in Russia. Another musician who joined Theremin, his name was Konstantin Kowalski. He made some changes to the Theremin Vox that allowed for short staccato notes. And Kowalski did over 3,000 concerts over a 50-year span on the Theremin Vox. As to his rights or patent, well, he received a patent in 1924, but there was a clever ruse to steal it. He was forced to sell it or transfer it to Goldberg and Sons in 1925. So goes it for the Soviet inventor. But by 1927, the theremin was so popular, he was being called the Russian Edison and the Merlin of the electronic sensory perception. He was heavily involved in early television development, too, and the state was interested in him as a scientist, and the Music Institute saw him as a cultural ambassador. So in July 1927, he was sent with a quartet of Moscow Philharmonic musicians to Germany, touring towns and cities. His wife was kept in Leningrad as insurance that Theremin would return. The Fourth Department, or the Intelligence Service for the Red Army, saw the tour as a great propaganda apparatus that distracted the population, and Theremin was just a magician in this respect. People were listening to his music while their pockets were being picked clean. Theremin and his quartet performed at the Frankfurt International Exposition. He had added a pedal and buttons that were added to his U.S. patent, and people proclaimed his demonstration the most interesting thing at the exposition among the chamber music and a great number of participants, calling it the sensation of the Frankfurt Festival. As a stunt, Theremin tried the trick he did with Lenin with German dignitaries, having them have a go at playing the theremin with him standing behind them with guidance. With Theremin's guidance, the Frankfurt mayor played the Pilgrim's Chorus from Tannhäuser. Indeed, Theremin was learning to speak the tongue of any country. While in Berlin, he played for an audience that included Albert Einstein and Bruno Walter. 5 days later, the Berlin paper devoted 5 pages to the new phenomenon, the theremin. So by November, the interest in the theremin vox had so much momentum, the Kremlin decided it was time to send Leon Theremin on a trip to New York. He'd had concerts all over Europe, and was in great demand in London, Hamburg, Munich, and Mannheim. And he was collecting orders for another instrument plus the theremin. And there were plans to outfit an orchestra of theremins. Now he was referred to as Professor Theremin. The critics called him the magician of music, saying he plays music of outer space, music of the spheres, asking what was this music without instruments. One cartoon captioned, "When the ether becomes our fairy godmother." I think you get the picture. Theremin has passed the tipping point, and his name is on the tip of every tongue. Theremin was offered a record sum of $35,000 for a single appearance in the United States. But as with anyone who knows fame, they are also confronted with opposition. An inventor, Frank Miller, issued a formal injunction of the U.S. patent Theremin applied for, and Miller even tried to get an injunction to stop the performance at the Metropolitan Opera. Theremin's response? Miller's patent didn't involve the hands the way Theremin's instrument did. He also said he was aware of Miller's patent of 1915, and that he thought Miller was stealing from another scientist, DeForest. Well, touche. In several of his American concerts, Theremin had musicians play theremin voxes in ranges representing violin, viola, cello, and bass. They played with orchestras to audiences of up to 12,000, places like Coney Island and the New York Stadium with the New York Philharmonic, and he was finishing his tour in the Boston Symphony in Boston Symphony Hall on October 7, 1928. And of course, there was talk of investment and the Theremin Corporation. Theremin would sell the rights for $50,000. He estimated the company would profit $1.7 million. Nevertheless, in early 1929, Theremin signed an agreement with RCA, and RCA agreed to pay him and his partner Goldberg $100,000 for the exclusive rights over 2 years, plus a 5% royalty on all the units sold. Then, at the end of 2 years, RCA would have the option to buy the patent for $500,000. The plan was to have production start in April, and sales would begin in June. But Theremin would then set up more international patents, plus his own company with a board and a second company in Panama. And he appointed a treasurer for all his companies, Morris Hillquit, who was an American politician with a worldwide reputation as a spokesman for socialism. Theremin and his partners audaciously set up the company in a manner that they represented all sides of the company, something that would be a clear conflict of interest in today's world. But wait, the plot thickens. Panama office was not only set up to be the focus of the New York company, the Theremin Corporation's seat, but it was right smack in the middle of the Soviet intelligence ring. The Theremin Corporation was now conveniently poised to transfer sensitive documents. Panama was already the center of Soviet infiltration of the American military, and now the Soviet Union had a method to ship stolen documents back to New York under the guise of the Theremin Patents Corporation. And the shifty setup of the company allowed the owners to be both buyers and beneficiaries, paying themselves. It's hard to explain, but the result of all this conflict of interest and self-paying board member setup was the corporation was depositing large sums in a murky institution called the International Union Bank. Murky because of circuitous channeling and routing. And by bouncing and shifting funds, it was maneuvering resources to finance espionage in the United States. Holy cow! From cellist to inventor to spy, that's the Theremin legacy. And American capitalism was unwittingly at the heart of it all. RCA was plotting a bonanza in the American market of RCA Theremins, the new official name. In their course due diligence, they took under consideration the opposing patents of Miller and DeForest. RCA was up against more than patent opposition. The Theremin itself was tricky to market because it was harder to play than promised. There were changes and adaptations because, like the radio and the piano, they wanted a Theremin in every house. The Victor Theremin was their flagship now. And to make even more trouble in Tahiti, the American Federation of Labor started investigating the Theremin Corporation in 1930. American corporations doing business with Soviet Russia caused suspicion, as well as concern that might prove problematic down the road. Pretty soon, Leon Theremin had started moving into the television realm of RCA. But now, RCA didn't really want to work with the Soviet scientist. RCA relinquished Theremin Television from their corporation, and pretty soon the house of cards came tumbling down. Theremin stockholders became skeptical and started pulling out. The other big electrical companies, GE and Westinghouse, they wouldn't take up Theremin either. By the end of 1930, RCA's plan to mass produce the Victor Theremin disappeared. The inventor, nearly broke, changed his whole business plan, getting away from the corporate tangle, registering his lab and residence in New York as the Theremin Studio on a certificate of conducting business under an assumed name. So he was pretty strapped, and he had to take out a series of loans. But one day he met the Rosens, who offered to help him out. They said he could use a brownstone next to their residence to use as a lab and to teach students how to play the theremin. Theremin was now ushered into the inner sanctum of New York's high society because Lucy Bigelow Rosen's grandfather was John Bigelow, the ambassador to France under Abraham Lincoln. And she and her husband built the 100-acre estate Caramore in Westchester. Lucy studied the theremin and popularized it during the 1940s. Meanwhile, RCA petered out completely. They built only 500 Victor Theremins and sold a little over 400. Leon Theremin had moved on, hanging on to the Rosens. He had captured the hearts of the New York wealth crowd, but the corporations were banging on his door, claiming him in breach of contract. His financial woes were at hand. He was borrowing and redirecting funds in hopes he could somehow land on his feet. Then one day, he met these two businessmen, these two investors, and he talked them into taking the plunge and forming a company with him. They called it Teletouch, and it made burglar alarms and space-controlled instruments in general. And one device, the Teletouch Ray, was installed in department stores and streetlights. The lights would turn on when the pedestrians broke a beam. And this saved electricity, which was expensive. But the company's solvency disappeared when a metal detector they installed at Alcatraz failed to detect a gun. So I'm going to pause this story right now, and I hope you tune in next week when we pick up the tale of Leon Theremin, his ether music, and espionage. Until then...
Wait, you're not going to finish the story?
Hi, Siri. Yes, I'm going to be late for opera, and this story kind of got more involved than I originally expected.
You can't just leave me hanging.
Yeah, sorry about that. It's a good story, isn't it?
What opera?
The opera is also about Russia, It's a true story that took place in 2016. It's called Denis and Katya.
Well, you better tell us about that too.
I will, next week. Have a great week, everyone, and see you next time.